Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week our guest is journalist, historian, and author Evan Thomas. His new book, The Road to Surrender, Leading Up to Hiroshima in 1945, is just superb. Remember, we'll take your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the link to this week's sponsor, Real Paper, in our show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. James, you and Simon Rosenberg have been lonely voices yelling, the Democrats not only are coming, they're winning everywhere. Well, more are going to start to listen to you all after Ohio by a resounding double-digit margin. Last I checked, about 14 points, rejected a duplicitous Republican effort to make voter referendums much harder. Several takeaways from this, and they're really important. The context was abortion. And there's going to be a November referendum that would overturn Ohio's law, which is a ban on any abortion after 6 weeks, no exceptions for rape and incest. The Republicans thought they could defeat this by raising the threshold by which it had to pass. They lost. That means the post-Dobbs lift, or again, it just signals anew, the post-Dobbs lift for Democrats remains powerful. An August election is never easy to organize, take two, and sources tell me they've rarely seen a better organized Democratic effort as this became a partisan matter. Now, that augurs well for Sherrod Brown's critical Senate race next year. His opponent may well be the Secretary of State, the prime advocate of this failed effort. And as we spotlight every week, this was another effort to screw the voter. Now, there are 36 states, James, that allow voter referendums. I was mixed on these, whether it was a great idea or not, but with Republicans radically gerrymandering legislatures and acting right-wing policies, this may be the only recourse. There will be other efforts in Ohio, I'm told, success in Arizona and a few other states. You're big on the new Florida chair. If so, there needs to be a huge effort in the Sunshine State to overcome hurdles and get referendums on the ballot there, because that's the only way they're going to get some success right now.
Well, all right, let's back up here and get some perspective. All right, in Kansas, you had a referendum famously on August 2nd, 2022, which won by 18 points, blowout. And then in the spring, you had the Wisconsin Supreme Court, 10 points, is utter electoral blowout in Wisconsin. Don't kid yourself. And then this thing comes in at a little over 14 in Ohio. But that's part of the story. The other part of the story is Democrats are winning elections, the few that they have, they're winning them all. Like Jacksonville mayor, Colorado Springs mayor, the House seats in suburban Philadelphia. It's a very a valuable tool in its own daily coos, or cost. They're reliable. They're left to me, but they're reliable. And they have an election tracker where they give you the all these off-year elections, and then they give you the Biden-Trump 2020 number, which a number in a vacuum is really not that useful. It's compared to what? The other thing that I would look at, and I may do it this afternoon on my own, but where this thing really did well was in the suburban counties around Columbus and Cleveland and Cincinnati, yep, to some extent. And I know, like, I think Knox County, which was a pretty Republican county, was a kind of 50-50 in this. I'm dying to see how this did in Jim Jordan's congressional district. It'd be almost hard to think they won, but they're pretty good. The big thing about what happened here, moving forward to Senator Brown's race, the Democrats have no infrastructure in Ohio because they have no money, and it's hard to build a state party if you don't have the governorship, no statewide office, no senators, no anything other than Senator Brown. That's all we got. But all of this organizing they have, and all of these names and all of these committees, and I mean, I guarantee this is 83% done by women in Ohio, the kind of meticulous organized they do. This is all going to be available to Senator Brown in the fall of 2024. So that's a bit, people in Ohio tell me to be a little bit cautious about extrapolating too much of this from the Senate race. But it's clearly a good, if not definitive, indicator, and the residual organizational benefit from this, I think, is good.
Oh, I think it is unquestionably good, and Brown's opponent may well be the Secretary of State who led the effort on this referendum, the unsuccessful effort on this referendum.
Frank LaRose.
And I looked at, I look at some of those counties, too. I look at Delaware County, for instance, which is north of Columbus, and it's a county that's not a swing county. It's a Republican-leaning county. I think it went 58-42 for this.
Yeah, that and even go a little further out.
Yeah.
You know,
you're right. It's a big deal. You can always read too much of it. You can read too much of it into Kansas last year. You can read too much of it into Wisconsin. You can read too much of it into Jacksonville. But you know, when you read too much into a whole lot of things, you start to read not too much into them. And that's what's happening.
You're right. But we don't read. We hadn't started. We're just starting to read something into it. I don't know how much it is, but I know when you win an election, but what you and even 2022, don't kid yourself. That was a Democratic win. Period. End of story. I know we lost some House seats, and we didn't have a very good night in New York, California. That was a win by any historical way to look at it one time or another. And this is being done, I might add, but the question ought to be asked is, how tied are American elections to presidential approval and direction of the country? Because it seems like it's not as powerful. I mean, in my formative years of working in politics and your formative years of covering politics, it was gravity that, two most important numbers in any off-year election, anything, was presidential approval and direction of the country. And they're not lining up the way they're supposed to. And it's a question that I don't know we have to answer to, but other people can think out loud with us.
Right. Well, it was a good day yesterday. And I don't want to exaggerate it, James, but I think if I were Sherrod Brown, I would feel good today. I would think the predicate's been set for it to be a better race than considered. I think earlier it was considered almost a toss-up, and I hate to just base it on one outcome this year, but I think Sherrod's a slight favorite now.
Okay. All right. Well, your lips. But
Donald Trump, if he weren't an existential threat to American democracy, what we've seen the last 10 days would be a farcical joke. Pathetic. After his third indictment, he escalated his crazy demagoguery and lies. Jack Smith is a thug. Biden is a crook. Secret Service is covering up Hunter's cocaine. Fulton County DA, who's about to hand down Trump's fourth indictment, the grand slam of indictments this year, had an affair with a rapper. Of course, it's a lie. He has two strategies, James. One, to delay until the 2024 election so he can dismiss or pardon himself, as he's going to be convicted if most, if not all, of these cases get to trial. And two, to incite his followers. I really believe he wants some violence and to try to intimidate Republicans, which he is. It's really this is what Trump's doing. It's dangerous. It's awful. I hope it doesn't work. I wish I were confident.
Well, he's done this all of his life. So he knows one strategy. Trump, at a basic level, is very primitive. He has one way to fight. Now, what he'd say is, I've been in 4,000 lawsuits. I've opened, 50 criminal cases against me, and none of them went anywhere. This is where I split. Now, I now have an important ally. I have long contended that there's no such thing as a modern Republican Party. And that efforts to chastise Republican politicians are just swatting at gnats. And that it was a personality cult. And I see that Judge J. Michael Luttig has said recently that the Republican Party no longer exists. And he's exactly right. And there's no sense in getting mad at Lindsey Graham. He's maybe better than most. And of course, he's pathetic, you know, politician, you know, weak as he can be. But that is what, to the extent that I don't think there is a Republican Party, but there are any remnants of it, that's what it is. It does not exist. And we got to understand that, to understand politics. And to the extent, and Trump is, he thinks his major lifetime achievement is ruining this political party. I think it's weird, but that's where we are. Thank you, Judge Luttig.
Yeah, yeah. Let me make two other points here, political points. One, I urge everyone to read Bret Stephens' New York Times column on Wednesday. He criticizes.
Yeah, see what he got. I saw that and I didn't read it. Yeah. Tell me what
All
he
right.
said.
Well, I'm going to tell you because you will read it and you will find it really, really good. He criticized Paul Ryan for saying he's opposed to Trump because Trump can't win. So he'd be for Trump, but Trump could win.
Yeah.
And I think as Stephens writes, I'm sorry, this has nothing to do with whether Trump can win or not. It has to do that he would be a danger to America. And any principled Republican or conservative should oppose him on those grounds. I really urge everyone to read the Bret Stephens piece today.
I'm going to read it. Usually I find him, he's a nice guy. Met him a couple times. He's not a bad guy at all. I find him kind of squishy and, well, Trump's bad, but look how bad, you know, but just good. I'm glad he wrote that. You're right. If he can't, so I'm not for him because he can't win. Oh, okay.
Great. I mean, that's
if he could
really
win, you'd be for him?
Exactly.
They hate Paul Ryan. They're not going to like you, Paul Ryan. You're the enemy. They hate you more than they hate Sherrod Brown. And these people will never, ever get over it. And I bet you, I'll give you one more thing. I bet you if you asked Paul Ryan who he's for, he'd say, well, I'm thinking about Tim Scott.
That's the default mechanism now.
Yeah, I ever saw one.
I have seen a little anecdotal evidence, and I'm not just trying to, vindicate my prediction that Trump would slip, but I have seen anecdotal evidence of a little slippage, just a little, a handful of Trump voters saying, hey, it may be time to move on. But you know what's an impediment right now, James, ironically, and a great source of strength for Trump is Ron DeSantis. Because he was long thought to be the chief challenger. But the campaign and candidate have proven so miserable that he's not going to be. But he's blocking anyone else from getting to that position. Now, I don't have any idea who the hell that would be. I'm not as high on Tim Scott as the establishment is. But eventually, the only way to take on or to beat Trump is to go one-on-one. That's where he may be vulnerable. And right now, Ron DeSantis is the best blocking back that Trump has to prevent that.
Well, let me say it here. I've said it before. I want to say it again. Florida Senate will be highly competitive in 2024. Quite simply, that's what's going to happen. All right. The great underappreciated thing is the deterioration that's currently going on across the board in the state of Florida, including the deterioration of the governor's numbers and the splits in the Republican Party. You're right. I think we all missed how bad DeSantis was.
I
don't think we stopped and thought about like candidate quality, his ability to do anything. It was impressive. I mean, the guy just ran over everything in the state, you know, won by about 19 or 20 points. But this is not the same as it was when DeSantis ran for re-election. The first person to get shot is always the campaign manager. All right, we all know that. And so they shook up the campaign. Now they're going to go with the GOP. They got to do everything. But I don't think you got to ask yourself: Is Ron Santos, is he capable of being any better? Is this just who he is? It's almost like he has some kind of medical condition that prohibits him. I'm not going to be a diagnosis, and people who have it is anything you can do anything about. But I always look at him, and it's something not right about that boy. I don't know.
I agree with you, James. And, you know, in a big state like Florida, California, you can win a governor's race with not much retail politicking. I mean, it really doesn't much matter. But you can't run for president if you are a lousy retail politician. Maybe you're not great. Maybe you're not Bill Clinton. But, you know, you have to have some talent there. And he has absolutely none. I think I quoted this before. Tom Rath in New Hampshire says that every time he campaigns, he loses votes. He's awkward. He's just, and it's just, I really thought that I don't know, 6 months ago, the nominee would either be DeSantis or Trump. I would take DeSantis out of that equation. Now.
Yeah, I like to, I think to continue to think that you, in a little bit, you know, a half a percent every day, that you might be more right than wrong, but it could be any number of challenges that Trump is facing. One of the big ones is he keeps talking about Chris Christie being fat. And Chris Christie would be the first to tell you that he's fat, you know, try to hide it. I think Trump might weigh more than Christie. I'd like to see them have a way off before the Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg fight. I think they could draw big ratings. If he likes big ratings. Man. You step on the scale. Yeah.
I like one that. Side I think that's other. Man, you could raise a lot of money, James.
Shit. How much are you thinking in the betting markets? Oh, my God.
I agree with you.
Would Christie be, what, a 12-pound favorite?
Yeah, I think I might make it more like 7 or 8. Don't forget Trump's taller. But
you got to get some points. You got to give Trump. We've got to set a line here. Is it 9.5 pounds? I don't know. But you're definitely going to have to set a line for this. You got to build some real excitement here. You know, you can have prop bets over 300, under 300.
Chris Christie, who's having a ball in this campaign, that I think he would, I really think he would warm to that idea because he knows what Trump's calling him and he's open about it. You know, let me make another point about Trump's health. Everybody talks about Biden's age and Biden's health. That's a very legitimate topic.
Absolutely.
But it's just as relevant for Trump. Trump is only 3 years younger, and he's in a lot worse shape. He's fat. He's obese. He doesn't exercise. He eats terribly. So I think the age issue is very legitimate with Joe Biden, and I think the age and health issue is very legitimate with Donald Trump, though it hasn't gotten much resonance so far.
Well, as we know, that weight can be longevity determinant.
Right.
And in order that voters can make a proper evaluation, I think they need to know his weight.
I think he lies about it.
Well, of course he does. Right. But put him on a get him a pair of boxing shorts and put him on a scale. They can make scales that are, you know, when you watch him weigh in for a big fight, those scales are back to the 100th of a pound. That's not hard to do. If we could find that out.
I love this one. All right, here it is. Here it is. The Chris Christie, Donald Trump way off. We're ready for it.
Yeah, the betting line, DraftKings.
No notes. Hey, James, we're talking on Wednesday, August the 9th. That's the anniversary of the last time an atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, Japan, to end World War II, 1945. Our guest, Evan Thomas, one of America's great journalists, has written, I think, maybe the best book on those momentous times leading to that, on the politics in America and Japan in the summer of 1945, drawing on diaries and correspondence of the major players. The book is The Road to Surrender, and everybody out there ought to get it. Evan, thank you for being with us. You know, I've read a fair amount on this because, like you, my dad was in the Pacific and would have been involved, presumably, in any Japanese invasion. Let's do this a little backwards and then get into your fascinating narrative. There, to this day, is still some debate over Truman's decision to drop the bomb. You write that you are totally convinced it saved many more lives than it cost.
Yeah. I mean, I had the same questions. Did we really have to drop, you know, both those bombs? Wasn't there a way to do a demonstration? And the more I got into it, the more I realized, no, there was no choice. why was that? Because the Japanese just were determined to fight to the bitter, bitter end. And part of that was a kind of a strange death wish. I mean, almost a suicidal thing that they went through. But part of it was not crazy because they hoped, the Japanese military, the military ran the show. Military hoped that if they could force America to invade, they could bleed us so much, they could cause so much death and blood that we would say, okay, you know, we won't occupy you. You can keep your emperor. And they also wanted to avoid war crimes trials. That was not nutty because if we had invaded, they, you know, the Japanese were waiting for us with a million men on the southern end of Kyushu, that where they knew we were coming, the beaches where we were coming. They had 7,000 kamikaze planes, and it would have been a bloodbath of just amazing proportions. That's undeniable. There's some view of, well, we should have, you know, said, okay, before we drop the bomb, you can keep the emperor. I don't think that would have worked. The emperor was a tool of the military, and the military wanted to fight.
Well, and you, as you say, the context in thinking about that invasion was 20,000 Marines lost at Iwo Jima and Okinawa, which would have been kid's play compared to the invasion. And given that context, was there any other real option other than using the bomb?
Well, yeah. I mean, we could have continued to burn them and strangle them. We had burned 60 cities. We could have kept on doing that. And we could have probably done a blockade that would have starved them. But that would have killed a lot more. You know, in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the death toll was appalling. It's about 200,000 all told, 100,000 quickly, 100,000 slowly. So that's a horrific number. But if we had blockaded them, they would have starved to death at much greater numbers. Their rice crop was the worst ever. They were down to 1,500 calories a person. They were going to have massive famine and disease. We could have done that, and that would have cost the lives of millions of Japanese, and not just Japanese. But we have to remember that Asia was largely occupied by Japan, China, and Southeast Asia, and that was a brutal occupation. And Asians, Chinese, Vietnamese, were dying at the rate of about 250,000 a month. That's a minimum number. So by ending the war, we saved a lot of Asians as well. It's a horrible. I imagine what it was like for the people making these decisions.
Right.
There is no good choice here. You either kill a couple hundred thousand people, or you lose a couple hundred, or many more. There's no good happy ending to this story. But I do believe, after spending a lot of time on this, that Truman and his guys made the right decision.
Well, I agree. I think you make a very convincing case, and I certainly agree with you. They did, however, delude themselves a little bit in contending the casualties would primarily be military.
Yes.
And they really weren't, were they?
Yes, this fascinated me because it really gets at how hard it is to make these decisions. So let's go to July 25th, 1945. That's about 10 days before the bombs fall. And that's the day that Truman makes or signs off on the decision to drop the bombs. And that's when the formal order goes out. And so Truman writes in his diary that night, he writes, "I have instructed the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, and he agrees that the target will be a purely military target, that it will be aimed at soldiers and sailors, not women and children." Well, what is he thinking? Because Hiroshima was the target. The aim point of the bombers was a bridge in the middle of the city. It was sure to kill. Now, it did kill about 10 to 20,000 soldiers, but it also killed 50 to 60,000 civilians right away. Most of them, of course, were women and children because the men were off at war. So what was Truman thinking? The answer is, honestly, I don't know. I can't get into his head, but I think what was going on, part of it is just human denial.
Right.
You know, we all practice this. Everybody does this. I do it. You do it. Everybody does it. And that day, Stimson and Truman had been discussing what to do about Kyoto. Everybody who's seen the movie has seen General Groves, Matt Damon as General Groves. Mm-hmm. And General Groves was a hard guy. And he kept putting, he ran the target list, and he kept putting Kyoto at the top of the target list. Kyoto is the ancient cultural capital of Japan, very beautiful city. You may have been there. And Henry Stimson kept taking it off the target list. This happened three times. Finally, Stimson goes to the president to take Kyoto off the target list. And Truman agrees. He takes it off the target list to spare the ancient cultural capital so that we won't look like, you know, even worse than we are. And I think that's what they were thinking about. You know, we spared Kyoto. Now, Hiroshima, Hiroshima did have military bases in it. It was sort of a military target. And I think they just rationalized it. But part of it was it's just hard to face these things.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until they really saw, also remember, it's a new weapon, brand new weapon. And they'd asked Oppenheimer, you know, the scientist, they'd asked him how many people is it going to kill? And he had said 20,000. Well, that's a lot of people, but it's a lot less than 70,000. So they didn't actually know how many. They weren't even sure how big the bomb was. I mean, the estimates, Oppenheimer's estimate was between 2 and 20 kilotons. Well, it was 12 kilotons in Hiroshima and 20 in Nagasaki. So it was bigger than they thought. So, but the point is, this is a new weapon. And they don't absolutely know for sure. Now, once they find out how bad it was, and this was very revealing to me. One of my heroes is Henry Stimson in this book. And on the day that he shows the photographs of Hiroshima to Harry Truman, he brings him the photographs, the aerial photographs. What does Hiroshima look like? It looks like the inside of an ashtray. I mean, it's just nothing left. It's just ashes. And so Stimson brings those photos to Truman, and Stimson has a heart attack that morning. Now, he's 77 years old. You know, he's an old guy, and maybe it's just coincidence, but I don't think so. I think he was just shocked and traumatized by what they had done. He has a bigger heart attack a couple of months later when he fails to do his plan for international arms control is rejected. He has another heart attack.
Evan, he's a central figure in this book, Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War. Tell us about him and his role, his thoughts, his conflicts that summer.
So Stimson is a figure, a rigid kind of seeming Victorian, old-fashioned Victorian, always stood erect, kind of the never complain, never explain type. You know, George Bush's mother would have loved him. And he was a stern guy, but he had a conscience. He called himself a Christian gentleman, and I think he was. And so he keeps a diary. And in his diary, it's inevitable that we're going to use this thing. There's no turning back. But he calls the bomb in his diary, he calls it by its code name, S1. He also calls it the terrible, the awful, the diabolical. He calls it a Frankenstein monster. His aide, John McCloy, was asked, how did Stimson think about the bomb? And McCloy's answer was, on his knees, because they were traumatized by this thing. But it didn't stop them from using it. It's not, you know, he used it. They used it. Stimson was sort of the chairman of the board of the Manhattan Project that built the bomb. But that doesn't mean they weren't traumatized by it.
Right. James.
So Evan, there was a kind of seems to me there was a third person in the ring other than the United States and Japan, a third country, and that was the Soviet Union. That had to weigh on Truman's thinking, the Japanese thinking. I mean, they had to be cognizant that they had the superpower, you know, a little bit to
absolutely. There's a whole theory. You're probably alluding to this called the revisionists. You know,
part
the academics get into this stuff, and they say that. What was Truman really doing? He was trying to intimidate the Russians. That the real reason we used the bomb was to wag our nuclear finger at the Russians because the Cold War was on the verge of beginning. And certainly his Secretary of State, Jimmy Burns, thought this way, no question.
Right.
Burns was a hard man, and he was an early Cold Warrior, and he did want to intimidate the Russians. So I think that's true. And I think Truman did too. But I don't think that was the predominant reason they used it. They did want to intimidate the Russians, but more, they wanted to end the war.
Right.
They wanted to beat the Japanese.
But they were cognizant of the Soviets.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. This comes up in their meetings. You know, comes up, Stimson says, or I guess it was General Marshall, the sainted General Marshall, the J- Army Chief of Staff, said, "Should we share the Should we share the secret of the bomb with the Russians?" "Absolutely not," says Burns. Burns isn't going to share anything with those Russians, and he's speaking for the president. So they reject early on the idea of bringing the Russians into the tent. Now, as it happens, the Russians had spies at Los Alamos and knew all about the bomb. So they already knew what we were doing, and when the bomb goes off, Stalin makes sure they get to work fast on building their own bomb. So it's not as if the United States shouldn't have been paying attention to the Russians. They should have been, but it was a bad idea to try to intimidate them with a bomb. And you know, you can say, or you can do a what if. What if after we dropped the bomb, we had shared the secret with the Soviets? What would have happened? Would that have put us on the road to arms control? That actually is what Henry Stimson wanted to do, because he thought, you know, we're going to get into a terrible arms race and somebody's going to use one of these damn things and it's going to be horrible. So let's share the secret. I, you know, these counterfactuals, as I call them, it's hard to know. I have my doubts, though, because the Russians, Stalin wasn't sharing. He didn't want to share anything either. He didn't. The idea of American inspectors in Russia, I don't think the Russians would have gone for it. So I don't really think that would have worked. I think we were fated to have this terrible arms race. Thank God it didn't kill us all. But I think we're kind of stuck with it.
So my family, like Al, a lot of veterans in the Pacific War grew up on a diet. And one of the things, and they might have been right on this, but at the family table, they talked about Okinawa changed everything. We thought we were on the way to win this freaking war. And God damn, what a, you know, I mean, that just proved to us that these sons of bitches were never going to quit.
No. Yeah.
Did Okinawa change the way Washington and Honolulu looked at this? Because that was pretty traumatic.
It sure was. Event. Well, first of all, you have Iwo Jima. Now, Iwo Jima is the size, is 1/6 the size of Nantucket. I mean, it's a spot in the ocean. That cost us 7,000 Marines. Then Okinawa, I think it's 12,000 Army and Marines and sailors too. So big death tolls. And it was shocking. Those are big numbers. And Harry Truman, when they're having a meeting on June 18th at the White House on whether to invade or not, Truman says, "I do not want to have Okinawa from one end of Japan to the other." So he's highly conscious of what a bloodbath Okinawa was, and that's informing them. But but Truman approves the invasion because they don't know what the hell else to do.
Right. Just quickly, I've read a fair amount, and some people claim Iwo Jima was unnecessary, that we could have just bypassed the whole goddamn thing. Is there some truth to that?
I've read that. They wanted it as a fairly limited purpose, as a place
refueling where, ran out of gas or
exactly,
something.
Exactly. It sounds like a pretty limited thing to get 7,000-8,000 people killed. Right. I'm not a military historian enough to know the answer to this. I've read the same stuff you have, that it was unnecessary.
So this is something in the family lore that I think is not true. And this is a myth that's taken hold of America. But I happened to be in a bookstore in Gulfport about 10 years ago, and I saw a book by a guy named Herbert Bix on Hirohito. Mm-hmm. And basically the myth is that he wasn't a bad guy. He was like sniffing chrysanthemums and kind of writing crappy poetry. And Hirohito was actually not a very good guy. And he was kind of in bed with all these, you know, crazy Japanese nationalists and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a big debate. I know about Bix's book won a Pulitzer Prize because he argued, no, Hirohito was not this chrysanthemum sniffing marine biologist. He was a bad dude who was in bed with the military. I spent a lot of time on this. I think, as usual, it's kind of, this is a muddy answer.
I'm sorry, we like muddy shit here.
This is muddy, but yeah, he was a chrysanthemum sniffer. The military was telling him a lot of stuff, and there are little things like Bix signed off on the use of chemical weapons or biological weapons. The emperor did in one case. The emperor's not opposing kamikazes. He's on board with the military. However, he's a semi-hero in my book because at the end, he does stand up to the military. They've been jerking him around for years, and they tell him a lot every day. He's involved. He's not just out there, you know, going for goldfish. He's involved, right. but they're lying to him. And in June, they say, we're going to take you up to a new palace that we've built up in the mountains, the final redoubt. We have an armored train and we're going to take you. And he says, no. That's an unusual moment of independence from the emperor. He doesn't want to go up there. He doesn't want to be there captive,
right.
Essentially.
Right.
And then, and this is the important part, when we start dropping atom bombs, the military still wants to fight on. General Anami, who's the war minister and a very, you know, he's like out of a book. He's a, you know, samurai. He wants to fight on. And the emperor says, no, we're going to surrender. He has to do it twice. but he does. But the point is, he does it. He says, we're going to surrender. And that usually the emperor just sits there silently, just says nothing at all and lets the military have its way. This time he said, no, I agree with Foreign Minister Togo. Togo's another kind of the Japanese hero of my book. And Togo's the one guy who wants to surrender. And the emperor sides with him. That took some courage because they weren't going to assassinate the emperor. But they might make him their stooge. And indeed, on the night before the emperor surrenders, there's a coup attempt. These hot-headed young Anami, the guy I mentioned earlier, the war minister, he kills himself. He commits harakiri. He puts a sword in his gut and a dagger in his neck, and he dies. But his lieutenants, they kill the head of the palace guard. When they kill his assistant, they lop his head off. And they forge orders giving them control of the palace. And they're running through the palace. What are they looking for? The emperor has just recorded his surrender speech. It was supposed to be played on national news the next day at noon. And these soldiers are running through. Where's the record? We want to smash it. We want to break the record so he can't give the speech. So the war will go on. Fortunately, they can't find the record because it's hidden in a room that's been reserved for ladies-in-waiting to the emperors. So they don't find the record. And so the coup fizzles out. The leader of the coup, a young colonel, goes out and he shoots himself out in the courtyard. And the emperor surrenders. The speech is unbelievable. He says, well, the war is not going quite as well as expected. They've been nuked twice in 10 days. But he doesn't use the word surrender. They accept the Potsdam Declaration. You know, the amount of denial kind of on both sides is amazing.
I have trouble getting the Togo's and the Tojo straight, but go ahead. Yeah.
Evan, the Japanese had tried themselves to develop a bomb unsuccessfully. On August the 5th or 6th, did they know or did they sense that America had a usable bomb?
Yes. They didn't want, again, denial. Because as you say, they had been trying to build one. They had a scientist and he just couldn't figure it out. And they didn't really have the industrial capacity. Nobody but the United States had that. You know, we built like the largest factories in history in Tennessee and Washington to build this bomb. And the Japanese couldn't do that. They got some way down the road. But the point is, they knew enough to know that you could do such a thing, that there was such a thing. So the military didn't want to hear this because it was going to screw up their plans to fight to the death. And they sent a team of scientists down to Hiroshima. They took them a couple of days to get there. But, you know, it was obvious what it was. And they, you know, then the Americans dropped a second bomb. And incredibly, Anami, the war minister, says, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if the whole nation was to perish like a beautiful flower? And he said, let them drop 100 more bombs. Now, partly that was bluster for his subordinates. He's kind of showing off what a tough guy he was. But it's also, they just weren't willing to surrender. And they had something called the Supreme War Council. Japan was run by about six guys, mostly military. They were divided on whether to surrender. It wasn't until the emperor intervened that night and made them surrender that they came around. Even then, it wasn't a complete surrender because they wanted to keep their emperor sovereign, a deity, and Washington refused to go along with that. So the Japanese had to surrender a second time. And most people don't know this. We were getting ready to drop a third bomb, a third atom bomb, this one on Tokyo. I know this because we know this because Truman told a British delegation that was seeing him on the 14th. Sadly, he said, I've decided to drop a third bomb on Tokyo. They weren't going to drop it on the palace. They were going to drop it in a burned out area. Most of Tokyo is burned out. 20 square miles were burned out. So they were going to drop it there as a kind of demonstration so they, the emperor could see the flash and hear the bang, and maybe that would get him around. They didn't have to do that because 5 hours later, Truman learns that the Japanese have surrendered this time for real, and that's the end of the war. But that's how close we came.
You mentioned several times Foreign Minister Togo. He was one of the three central figures in your book, and his diaries were fascinating. Tell us a little bit more about him.
He's kind of an unlikely hero. Even his friends thought he was charmless. He's a doer.
And he wasn't fully Japanese, was he?
No, he was Korean. That's important, actually. He was Korean heritage. He changed his name. His name was Park, but his father had bought a samurai name so they could fit in better. And this is, in Japan, this is important. He was not really, you know, one of them. And that gave him a little bit of distance. He studied German philosophy. He liked Goethe and Schiller. And he was kind of a humanist. He didn't like the Nazis. He thought they were thugs. And he stood apart from the militaristic clique. This was important because he had some independent judgment. Now, he's also a brave guy because in Japan, if you were against, you know, the word surrender was forbidden. You could not use the word surrender. As Carville, I'm sure you know from reading all these histories, the Japanese fought to the death. You're not allowed in the military, Japanese military conduct, code of conduct, you're not allowed to surrender.
Right.
So their battalions, they would, you know, a battalion of 600 people would lose 590, you know, and the other 10 would kill themselves. You know, they just were going to fight to the death. That was the military code. And Togo was a little apart from that. He was brave about it because there was a chance he'd get assassinated. The Japanese were not, you know, in the 1930s, I think two prime ministers were assassinated by these young hotheads who were militarists. And so it was a scary thing to stand up to the militarists. You took life into your own hands. And so my man Togo was a brave guy.
You know, I'm fascinated by one part of your fabulous book. Most of the central players, Stimson, General Carl Spatz, another head of the American Strategic Force, another central figure, and Oppenheimer, they all went to their graves feeling a little guilt, or more than a little guilt, over what they had unleashed. Do you suspect they would be surprised today to see that that bomb hasn't been dropped again in more than three quarters of a century?
They'd be gratified. I mean, you know, they feared that they'd unleash something. Oppenheimer, there's that scene in the movie. I think it's a little overplayed, but he goes to Truman and he says, I feel I have blood on my hands. Right. And Truman kicks him out of the office. In the movie, Truman's kind of contemptuous of him and sneers at him. I doubt it. I doubt that's what Truman did. But I do think it's true that Truman did dismiss him, and Truman, you know, said, look, it was my decision, not his. He maybe referred to him as a crybaby. But the point is that, you know, Oppenheimer was really upset by what he had done and thought that he had unleashed something on the world that would be used. And I think they all feared that. And it's a miracle. It's a miracle that it hasn't been. Now, I think that's partly because it was so awful.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie, you know, book, John Hersey's book, Hiroshima's, you know, reached a lot of people, and people saw how horrible it was, that it created a taboo. I wrote a book about Eisenhower, and I read the minutes of the National Security Council, and they were thinking about using an atom bomb on Korea in the Korean War. And they talked about this taboo, especially a taboo against using this horrible weapon in Asia another time. And that you could actually feel that restraining policymakers from using that weapon, an atom bomb in Korea. There's a taboo. That taboo has lasted to today. Now, I worry that, you know, people have sort of forgotten how terrible these weapons are. And you have Putin, you know, talking about tactical nuclear weapons, and there's, you know, you even hear talk about the idea of a limited nuclear exchange with China over Taiwan that's in some of these war games. Boy, I maybe you could have a limited nuclear exchange, but I don't want to find out.
Boy, I sure agree. James?
So Evan, you brought up the scene in Oppenheimer. That thing left me wanting. It wasn't very realistic. I didn't think that's who Truman was or who Jimmy Burns was. I mean, I know he's trying to recreate. That was not a high point of that movie.
I thought the movie was tried to be pretty accurate generally, but that scene bothered me because that sneering countenance. I don't think that's the way Truman. I'm quite sure that's the way Truman was not. I just don't believe that. I believe that Oppenheimer went to him and said, I feel I have blood on my hands. I do believe that Truman sat there and kind of listened to him and said, okay, see you later.
Right.
But I doubt he sneered at him.
But that guy didn't convince me as Truman, and the guy didn't convince me that he was Jimmy Byrne. I mean,
They were actors playing themselves. Wasn't that Gary Oldman? Yeah. That was Gary Oldman playing Gary Oldman.
It was.
Before I let you go, my favorite thing is, of course, I was born, like we all internalize history. I was born October 25th, 1944, a date you know something about. And just tell our listeners about the USS Johnston, which I think is maybe the most glorious ship in the history of the United States
Navy.
Tell us about the Johnston.
Yeah, the Johnston. It was commanded by a Cherokee Indian, really unusual. A Cherokee Indian graduating from the Naval Academy in the 1930s. I mean, there were maybe one or two of them.
Right.
Ernie Evans was his name. When the Japanese fleet appeared on the horizon on that morning, and he's in his destroyer, what does he do? He steers straight for him. And this is a destroyer taking on the largest battleship in the world ever built, the Yamato. And they launch these torpedoes. They actually blow the bow off of a cruiser. And then they get involved in an hour and a half running gun battle with pretty much the entire Japanese fleet. And they eventually get sunk, but they stay alive for a long time. And Evans dies. The bridge has been blown up. He's steering the ship from the fantail, from the stern of the ship, yelling instructions to turn to his men who are pulling on the rudder cables. I mean, this is just, it's like 18th century warfare. And he dies. Nobody ever sees him. And the men go in the water. A lot of them, they're sharks. The U.S. Navy forgets about them for a couple of days. God, it's just an unbelievable story of heroism.
Right.
And somebody should do a movie about that.
Right. Didn't he get the Medal of Honor? Was he posthumously given the Medal of Honor for this?
Yeah, Medal of Honor.
I just wrote one of my favorite stories. You wrote that in the book, and I was just so moved by the story and the heroism.
Me too.
And it was just a little bitty shitty destroyer that wasn't even designed for ship to ship combat, honestly. Yeah,
but this guy had no doubt. I interviewed a guy who was in an anti aircraft gun right below the bridge, and this ship starts to turn, and he thinks, "Great, we're getting out of here." Because they can see the Japanese fleet on the horizon. Great, we're getting out of here. And the ship keeps turning until it's heading right for him. And the kid, this is a young man, he thinks, I'm going to die. Now he lived. He survived. Right.
What a contribution you've made. And it's just such a fascinating part of history. I mean, we still, we're going to live with it,
I would just tell everybody out there, go read, go buy first, and then read Road to Surrender. It is the best account I've ever read on those incredible months leading up to August 6th. Evan, thank you so much for being with us. You have done an incredible job.
Thank you, James.
Congratulations.
Thank you, really
enjoyed it. I'll come down and see us at Walter's book party.
Okay.
See you later.
I'll do that, Evan.
Yeah, good deal.
All right, guys.
All right.
Now for the outrage of the week. James, Jack Goldsmith, a Harvard and Hoover Institute law professor, a conservative who presents as reasonable, wrote a New York Times editorial assailing Jack Smith's indictment of Donald Trump for trying to overturn a legitimate election, and including inciting a violent mob. Goldsmith's charge, and he is a really high-powered figure in the legal world, his charge comes straight from the Trump playbook. A, he says it looks political. Biden, it looks like Biden is trying to smear his likely opponent. B, he contrasts what's happening to Trump with the specious charges of Russia's ties to the 2016 campaign, ignoring the certifiable reality. Check the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mr. Goldsmith, that Russia sought to help Trump in that election, including some very sleazy direct connections. And then he had the what about Hunter Biden getting off easy. As conservative former federal judge J. Michael Luttig notes, Trump has committed one of the gravest offenses against the United States, and it's, quote, downright silly, end quote, to compare it to whatever Hunter Biden did. James, I am sure that Goldsmith would dismiss criticism from hacks like us, even given your distinguished LSU law degree. So let's turn to the aforementioned Judge Luttig. He's got better conservative credentials than Goldsmith, more experience in the executive and judicial branches, and he's more respected. He notes that Goldsmith is making a partisan political pitch, which, quote, misses the case for the nation, which is imperative for the prosecution and trial of the former president. This would make, without that, it would make a mockery of America, the Constitution, and the rule of law. That's what this is about, James, the rule of law, not partisan politics.
Well, I did read that, and I got to tell you, I had the same reaction you did. And that there's no penalty for letting the former president of the United States run wild on a crime spree, a lifelong crime spree. I mean, that's insane. The Times doesn't, I'm fine with them publishing different opinions, and they should, and I defend them for that. But this was so fucking vapid and stupid and made no sense. They should have given him another form to do it. I mean, my God, there's no, so you tell a third grader you can't cheat on a math test, and the president of the United States is on a crime-free cheating and lying at every point, and there's no consequence to it. It's vapid and it's stupid. Well, my outrage is, it's not so much an outrage. I read Puck. You know, it's very coastal and it's snarky, but it's fun. And William D. Cohen, who's a good financial journalist, by the way, I've read some of the books he wrote on financial crisis, went to the Hamptons and saw David Rubenstein, who is the icon of icons. And Rubenstein, he writes a story, and actually Steve Schwarzman, who's a big hedge fund, I don't know, trillionaire, talked about, well, maybe what Biden should do is get Trump to ask him for a pardon and make him pay a big fine and try to talk to people down in Fulton and, you know, blah, blah, in the interest of the country. Well, I tell you this, we've been talking about this for the past 6 months on this show. I mean, we didn't talk about it in the Hamptons, all right?
And our Zoom calls on Sunday. You're right.
Our Zoom calls on Sunday. I mean, this is...
Goddamn, like, James.
Yeah,
we'll never get to the Hamptons.
We'll never be David Rubenstein and Steve Schwarzman. But when I read it, I went, well, holy shit, Al and I have been like... And we've been gaming it out. Now, the one thing that they added... that, you know, they said, well, and then Biden could say he's not going to run. But, all right, come on. I don't views whether Biden should run or not, but that's so Wall Street-y, if you will. But it was almost, when you read it, it's exactly the same shit we've been saying for every Sunday for 6 months. Is, you know, what would you do if you were Biden and this happened? By the way, that scenario, I don't know, it doesn't get any less likely. I mean, it's just... The country's got to, I don't agree with Jack Goldsmith at all, but we got a lot to deal with here.
Yes.
And letting him go is not one of them at all. I mean, there's got to be, but it's going to take some ability to land this airplane.
No, you're right. Look, this is a dangerous trail we're on. There's no question about that. There are real dangers and downsides to what we're doing. It would be far greater dangers and downsides not to do what Jack Smith is doing. And I think the one thing I would add, I think we've agreed with any possible pardon, has to involve an admission of guilt. Without an admission of guilt, you wouldn't even consider a pardon. And that's going to be tough for Donald Trump.
And what I'd do if it was me, I would order, like, I don't know, Price Waterhouse, I don't know, international, one of these, you know, international accounting firms. I'm sure they're all thieves. But have one of them do a complete audit and make him pay 2/3 of his net worth.
Yep.
Now, don't take his word for shit. But what's Mars? I don't know. One of these. There's some, you know, some forensic accountants and that do all this. And I would, and he has to turn everything over, and he sees 2/3 of all of his assets. I don't know why I leave him with a third. He doesn't deserve that, but it's a convenient number.
You're being generous.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. You know, we'll never get to the Hamptons, but we were there first.
No, we were not going to get there. But just what I read, it's if I ask our listeners to read it, and it's just exactly the same shit you've been hearing on this show forever.
You give me a choice between working with you and our podcast and our wonderful Zoom call on Sunday the Hamptons. I'll take the former any day of the week. Okay, now we go to our listener questions, which are one of our favorites always. James, the first comes from Melvin in San Jose, California, who says, in 48, Harry Truman was believed to be unelectable. Even his own people were convinced he was going to lose. So he decided the best strategy was go directly to the people of the country in person and speak plainly and directly about his voting record and tell them if they voted for him, they were voting for themselves. Truman went everywhere. Can we expect that from Biden?
I think that that's what they are trying to do. I mean, sort of their options are a little bit fewer than what Truman had. And, you know, Dewey was a good follower at a different time. But the one thing that only would give Democrats some hope is, you know, we talked about in the show, the presidential approval and direction of the country doesn't seem to be the determinative fact in these elections. And, you know, I don't know. But what people are scared of is that the Biden numbers just don't get any better.
And
somehow, I don't know how, it's hard to see how they would get a credible candidate up between now and next summer. But if they did, it would be troubling. But it's a good point. I think they're really trying to do this. They're trying to push him out more. Because, of course, he's kind of limited. What he can do, I mean, his schedule has got to be very limited for sure. So they're trying, though. I'll give them credit. They're trying to push his accomplishments.
No, and they're going to go. They say they can go every week to some community and talk about some new infrastructure project, some new manufacturing project, some clean energy thing. So they have the material out there. And, you know, presumably, or as to be hoped for, that Biden has the energy to pull that off.
Right. That's right.
I'm Sir Jeffrey in Seattle, Washington, says, do you envision a scenario where all living former presidents and vice presidents, Democrats, and more importantly, Republicans, would do a video together urging all citizens to vote against Trump because of his threat to the democratic foundations of the country? No, Jeffrey, I don't think that's going to happen. I think George W. Bush feels that way. I doubt he would participate in a video. Certainly Sarah Palin wouldn't. But I tell you what I did. I tell you what I do advocate. And because I think there's going to be hundreds and thousands of former officials, former Justice Department officials, former defense officials saying that Trump is a threat. What I'd like to see is, Jim, just a handful of people at the very top of the Trump administration, James Mattis, Rex Tillerson, John Kelly, H.R. McMaster, put out something that, Not opposing Trump, but to say that he is a national security threat to America, that they would worry about the safety of the country and the world if he were elected, because they have dealt with him and he's unqualified. James, I don't know if that would make a difference, but it strikes me that that would be, I can't think of anything better.
Well, first of all, I don't know if I agree with you on President George W. Bush. I'm more inclined to think he would do something like this. I mean, I do know that, like, he'd detest him at a level you can't imagine. And I don't get Rex Tillerson. Honestly, I never saw a man lose so much. You know, he was CEO of fucking Exxon. That's a in Dallas, Texas. That's as big as you can be. He was big in a Boy Scouts. He was everything. And Trump just humiliated him. I mean, just fired him from the toilet seat. And at every juncture, and the guy just sits there and plays gin rummy at the Dallas Country Club. I mean, goddamn, man, go open your mouth and tell people what a staggering threat. You called him a fucking moron, and you were right. And, you know, tell us why. Mm-hmm. And that would go to, you know, General Kelly. The one that told General Kelly that, I don't see what these soldiers were doing, you know, coming over here fighting. They were all losers. I mean, come on. Are you? Of course you told Jeffrey Goldberg that. Tell us more. I mean, I don't know if it'd do any good because, you know, when you look at these Trump people in the interview, I'd like to know what percent of the people at a Trump rally, I'd love for somebody to take a poll question. If Trump was sentenced to a year in jail and you could, would you take his place? And I bet you would get a lot more people agreeing to that than you think. I think these stupid people, if they could, would go to jail for him. I really do. But
Bill in Havertown, Pennsylvania, James, says all the right. Youth vote turnout is going to be low no matter who's running. Oh, they need to be instructed in the importance of voting. What do you do?
Look, the most disturbing thing to me is, okay, the Biden's approval is 41.5. That's not very good. That's disturbing. The really disturbing thing, and it's true of any poll you look at internally, our number among blacks is very lukewarm, and our number among, and I'm talking about Biden's number among under 30 is very lukewarm. Now, people will say, well, you're going to win. You're going to win. You know you're not going to lose blacks. You're going to get over. Well, yes, but it's all about, and take 30 seconds to explain this. It's all about share. And if you don't have a robust share among black voters, something 12 is fairly ideal. Obama got 13. That's pretty hard to duplicate. But if you fall lower than that, the share is going to go up somewhere else. Yeah, a share of the overall vote. And it's not just if the black share is 11, that don't mean you just getting 1% less of a constituents that you get 93% of, somebody else is getting more.
Right.
And the same thing with young voters. And I think it's like under 30, 17%, but I don't hold me to that. It's in the back of my mind. But if you don't hold up your end of the bargain, that's how you're going to lose. Right now, you know, they can't stand Trump and they're not Republicans, but they're not very excited about voting Democratic either. And that's not a good sign.
No, it sure is not. Jeremy in Clarksville, Arkansas says, explain what happens if Donald Trump is the Republican nominee for president, but has been convicted by one of these charges. Does he stay the nominee or does it go to someone else? And what if he is the nominee, but the Republican convention hasn't made their choice yet? Can they go against the voters? It is entirely up to the Republican National Committee. And there's two points I would make. Number one, by all accounts, Trump has taken over and dominates the Republican National Committee, which has a weak chairperson. So my guess is that Donald Trump, no matter whether he's convicted or not, if he's got the necessary votes, he's going to be the nominee.
There's no Republican Party. I mean, the idea that there's some, you know, Chamber of Commerce guys and everything, and they're going down to the country club and, you know, scratching out plans. No. And he's in complete control, and they can't bow it. They can't win an election without him. So let's just assume that he's convicted. Even he's in jail. That's going to make it even harder to get rid of him.
Right.
Not easier. Harder.
Right.
And we just got to – it's hard to, like, be, you know, almost 79 – and have to come to grips that something that you've known all your life no longer exists, that would be the Republican Party, but it no longer exists. It's over. You're right, Judge Ludick. It does not exist anymore. And their personality cult, and they're not going to change.
James, Linda in Louisville, Kentucky, via New Orleans, asked, Why aren't we being reminded of the disaster Trump was in handling the decade's biggest crisis, the COVID crisis? Will we see commercials of his incompetence? You know, perhaps his primary proponents will remind everyone. I think probably not, Linda, but he was a disaster. His own top expert on this said he probably cost a couple hundred thousand lives. And yet it seems to have disappeared, James.
Well, first of all, I can't wait. I'm coming up to Louisville doing a fundraiser for Governor Beshear on 22nd of August. And I love Louisville. It's one of my favorite places. It reminds me a lot of New Orleans. You know, they have the fleur-de-lis, the same symbol we do. So I'm looking forward to that. What was the question? I lost my
The question was COVID. Trump's disastrous performance.
All right. On COVID, you got to understand Republican voters. Oh, DeSantis is attacking him for doing too much.
Yeah.
It's not going to help you with Republican voters saying, he didn't take this. I mean, it's going to help you if he didn't take COVID serious enough. That's what they want to hear. Remember, he told Bob Woodward on fucking tape at the beginning of this, I'm playing this down. The death rate in the United States was one of the highest of all of the industrialized advanced nations in the world. We had over a million people die. And 40% of the country said, "Oh, it wasn't that much." They overblew it. That's how nuts the country is. It's a point, but they can't run on that because DeSantis is not being doing very successfully. But remember when Trump went to North Alabama and told those people to get vaccinated?
And he got booed.
They literally booed him.
Right.
All right. They don't want to hear that shit. It was all made up, and Dr. Fauci and, international cartel, whatever. It's all so fucking insane and depressing and everything. And you know what? They're not going to get better because they wallow and they relish their own goddamn ignorance and stupidity. I'm sorry, but that's it. But thank you for the question, but they – that's not what's going on.
I agree, James, sadly. Cindy in Berwick, Pennsylvania, says it seems strange that Mark Meadows so far seems to come out clean in all this, and he's been very quiet. Do you think he's talking to the higher-ups? I do. I don't know anything, but I do. I suspect that Mark Meadows may be Jack Smith's best secret witness. If that's right, I think Mark Meadows knows everything. You saw when his aide, Cassidy Hutchinson, testified before the January 6th committee, and I think she knew a lot, but Meadows knows a lot more. It was very revealing. And if Mark Meadows has turned, two things. I'm looking forward, A, to what he says. I'm looking forward to how Trump now describes his former chief of staff and chief confidant.
You know, in the history of crime literature, one of the most famous titles ever was a Sherlock Holmes book called The Dog That Didn't Bark.
Yep.
Okay. This dog is not barking. I wonder why, because that's not the normal instinct. And I guess it was Michael Cohen, but it's hard for me to see how he's not government evidence. It just really is. I mean, he hadn't said a word. He hadn't been subpoenaed. He hadn't been mentioned. He's not co-conspirator number six, any of that stuff. I mean, about every tell that you can imagine is flashing, this guy is going to show up on the witness stand. But maybe there's another explanation by any thought. I mean, this dog is not barking, and that's very significant.
I agree. Finally, Elizabeth in Embryville, Pennsylvania. We're a big Keystone State questions today. She said, we can't convince Biden to step aside for a younger candidate. So rather than sitting around worrying about the end of our democracy, I think we should devise a plan to decrease the chances of that happening. So, James, she's going back to the second of your worries, which is, why is black voter enthusiasm down and what can we do to change it?
Thank you. That's the money question. The answer is, I don't know. But no one, and you're doing something that I cannot get people to do is ask the question, why we don't have a large research project commissioned to find out some in-depth attitudes. And I think a lot of our problem, my guess is, I would really look at blacks under 40, but we're not connecting. They're not connecting with us. And Biden, by the way, he's I think, hands down the best president black America ever had.
Just look at the numbers. Look at the jobs and everything
else.
I
can't tell you, but inspirationally in terms of identity, but the performance of black America under Biden significantly better than it was under Obama than anybody. No one. The differential in employment rate is down to numbers that you wouldn't believe. There's still more whites employed, but not nearly like it used to be. And, hourly workers, which are a huge number of blacks in the United States, they've had – and the appointments have been, staggering. So we're not – it's not connected. The two, we haven't put them together. And thank you, but you at least you're thinking about it and noticing it. I don't see other people thinking about it or noticing this. I really don't.
I raised it with a top White House person who I saw at an event, and the answer basically was, look, we're doing great. We're beating, we're getting 80% of the black vote or whatever. That's irrelevant. I mean, if you get 90% of 11%, that ain't the same as getting 89% of 14%. I mean,
the share goes somewhere else. That's stupid, antiquated thinking. It is a problem. It is a problem, and it's all across the board a problem. And it's being masked by the fact that we doing, really well in these elections. But and plus, it's the most important voting constituent in the Democratic Party. And for some reason, we're not exciting them, and we ought to find out why.
James, before we go, I want to just report to you the news that just came in that Dylan Cruz for the Fredericksburg Nationals today hit a Grand Slam home run.
Oh, my goodness.
That's the future.
I hope, man. We need a future. We hit one in Fredericksburg?
I believe so. It's a Grand Slam, and it says FXBG Nats. That looks like Fredericksburg to me.
It's got to be. I wonder what Skanes and all these young people we saw in the College World Series, Rhett Lauda, you got. And watch us, this guy from Florida, man. He's good, too.
A lot of good young
Wyatt, players. But something like.
Listen, we love those letters, those emails, the great questions. If we didn't get to yours today, because we can't get to all of them, please send it in again next week. So thank you for the questions. We love them and keep them coming. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the link to this week's sponsor, Real Paper, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.